Okay, we're starting 1 Samuel chapter 8 this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and for those of you who may be joining in for the first time this morning, and we are engaged in a study of the books of what is sometimes referred to the historical books or the books of the history of Israel. Of course, that designation leaves a bit to be desired because it's more than just historical information. We know we're given teaching about the things that happened to Israel from its beginning as a nation or a physical kingdom and all the way through to its end, to the end of the Old Testament time, really. But we're given that information because of the importance of our seeing examples from there, learning of God and His ways and His judgment. So there are innumerable valuable lessons and things that we need to learn from studying those books. But that's what we're doing now. So we had started back in the book of Joshua some time ago. So we've covered Joshua and Judges and Ruth. And so now we're in 1 Samuel and we're in chapter 8, which this is a pivotal chapter, not only in the book of 1 Samuel, but in the history of Israel, because 1 Samuel chapter 8 is going to begin a transformation or transition in the very type of government that Israel had. For everything up until now, from the time that we started the book of Joshua, which was picking up from the end of the time of Moses leading the Israelites, and Joshua then took over the leadership of Israel and was Israel's judge. And from that time entering Canaan and conquering Canaan all the way through to now, to the time of Samuel, from Joshua to Samuel, all that we've looked at in these books, this has all been under the system of government chosen by God for Israel, known as the Judges, yes. But now, starting here in chapter 8, Israel is going to demand a king, and they want to be ruled by kings. So we're going to see, it'll take a few chapters before all this is settled out and Saul becomes the first king of Israel. But here's where it's starting. Samuel, the prophet of Israel and judge of Israel, is now old in age. Israel is going to demand a new system of government. They want to be like the nations around them. They want to have a king. And God is going to grant them their desire, their demand. Even though we'll see that this was not pleasing to the Lord, this was not consistent with the desire He had for them. But we'll have a lot to look at in this chapter as Israel is putting this demand forth to God through Samuel, but demanding a king to rule over them and lead them. But this is going to be a major change for Israel. Israel's never going to be the same after this, until finally, when there's only the tribe of Judah and the remnants of the others that had joined with her, when coming back from the Babylonian captivity, God restores the system that He had in place from the beginning. They won't have a king anymore after that. But for all of these years from this point onward, we're going to see a decline spiritually for the nation of Israel. And it's really something that we need to learn from, because these kinds of things, the types of problem Israel had and the traps they fell into in their thinking are things that still cause trouble for people today and can for us if we're not aware of those, if we don't learn these lessons. All right, so without any further ado there, let's start in chapter 8, looking at verses 1 through 3, as this is going to set the stage now for why of the timing of this demand, part of the reason we're going to see in these first three verses here in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And Brother Stephen, would you read that for us, please? 1 to 3.
Pass and Samuel of old, and he made his son judge over Israel. Now the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of the second was Bah. They were judges over Beersheba. And his son walked not in his way, but turned aside after the Lucre, and took bribes and reversed the judgment.
All right. I didn't get the box of pens here. So, sometimes I'll put a crude map on the board. I'll apologize for anybody that is a real technical geographer, because this is not what's going to appear here. But just to give us a little bit of perspective, it helps if your pen has a tip to it, but okay. All right, how's that for Israel? Here's the Mediterranean Sea. This bears no resemblance to anything your mind can wrap around. Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee. This is the Jordan River. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. So we have the west side of Israel and then the east side on the Jordan. But what we read about at the end of chapter 7 was Samuel serving as the judge of Israel. And he was judging the people moving in a circuit of cities that it told us in verse 16. From Bethel, Gilgal, Mizpah, and he lived in Ramah. But if you look on a map, that covers which area of Israel, roughly? It's over in this vicinity here, roughly. But we have a vast amount of territory down here where the tribe of Judah is, which is not just a large area in terms of square miles, as we would describe it now, but it was also a very populated area. Judah was a numerous tribe, as well as a large tribe. Where is Beersheba?
In the south.
I mean, it's probably going to be down here off the board a little bit, but it is the southernmost settlement or town in the territory of Israel. We frequently read in Scripture. The top part, the most northern point in Israel, Dan, and you read in the scriptures a lot of times when he's talking about something that covers the entire expanse of Israel from Dan to Beersheba, which means from one end to the other. But Samuel, being old, and he is judging in this circuit around here, well, there's a lot of territory where he's not covering. The people can still come to him. But would there be a need, or could there be a need for having some to assist him in judgment in some of these places that are some distance from there, were in an area where a large segment of the population may have a difficult time getting to Samuel? And of course, as a judge, part of their main job, and this goes back to the you can go back to Exodus and Numbers when Moses actually became the first judge of Israel, and some of the conversations he had with his father-in-law. The most difficult cases of judgment would go to the judge, but he would have judges under him that would handle the matters before they would reach the very top. But they had judges in other places that were serving under the judge, the overall leader of the nation. But would it make sense to have some judges down in this area is really the question. And that would serve a good purpose, except for there's a problem. He puts his sons in as judges, and they were placed in Beersheba. His two sons, Joel and Abiah, and they're made judges down there. Now, would that have worked well if they were like their father? If their heart were like their father, Samuel, this would have worked well. Unfortunately, they were not. So here's where we start to have a problem. Were they, Andy?
So were these not the judges in the same sense that Samuel or Samson or any of the others were?
Not as being the very top. These were under, Samuel is still the judge, so that he appoints them as judges in this place. So this would be more along the lines of what we read about when Moses had the judges that were under him to help with the cases as they were the more difficult ones. So there was a structure to this system where you had the judge, but you had judges in other places that would work under the overall judge. So this would be similar to what we saw with Moses. And no doubt, all the way through, there have been there's been this system in place, and there have been other judges to help, but they're not the top, because that was always chosen by God, which we're going to get into in a little bit here. And one of the things that also kind of goes along with that, as another point that we'll try to cover in more detail in a few minutes too, is that with the judges, when we're looking at his sons being made judges, did this mean that they were going to, when Samuel died, that they would be the top, that they would take Samuel's place as being the top leader in Israel? Was that the pattern that was followed in the time of Judges? In fact, did that ever happen? Did we ever have a case where a son succeeded the father as judge? Because God was choosing the judges. And that's one of the big differences between the judges and kings. Because that's exactly what happens in a monarchy. The king dies and his son inherits the throne. That's not the way it worked with the judges.
The only case would be where Gideon's son tried to usurp the power.
Yeah, exactly.
That didn't turn out well.
Exactly. I was going to mention that one. Of course, he was eyeing to be a king. Because the people had given Gideon that opportunity after that great victory over the Midianites, that God did in such a fashion that they would all know it was not man but God that did it. So Israel's initial response to that was to credit it all to Gideon and make him the king. So that was not very good on the part of Israel then. But Gideon, of course, being righteous as he was, refused it. Nevertheless, when he died, one of his sons, one of his 70 sons, decided, well, I want to be king. And so he did make himself such. And Judges 9 was a disaster. That chapter tells about the disaster that befell Israel during that time. And of course, he ended up not being killed. But no, that didn't work well at all. But that was the only case where somebody tried it. But they were going to actually try to be king then and make Israel a monarchy back then. So there's one other time before this where there was an opportunity in Israel, and they came close to start shifting that government to a monarchy with a king instead of the judges. But under the judges, you didn't have the son or a son to take over after the father died, like in the case of kings. But here he has his sons working under him as judges in Beersheba. They're not like their father, unfortunately. So they're younger, clearly, and Samuel is now old. So the people are looking at this situation, and now as he's giving more of the work over to some others, and they're not doing it like he has been doing it for all these years, then there's some dissatisfaction, some unhappiness on the part of the people because of this. This is going to have a bearing on the timing of their demand right here. But would it have happened right then and there, this demand for a king that comes up, if Samuel's, these two sons were righteous? I mean, the hearts of the people were still this way. I mean, that's not what made the people to have the problems in their heart where they would make the demand. But it certainly could have at least delayed that or kept a lid on things for a while longer if his sons had been righteous.
Well, and a lot of things, athletics are a good thing. If you got a coach you don't like, as long as you're winning, nobody cares that he's there. In the same situation here, if they were doing things right, no one would. You know, it wouldn't be as big an issue.
Right, exactly. It wouldn't provoke the situation now where they can, the grumblers are going to be able to rise up and have anybody to really pay attention to them. So this gives an occasion for them. And of course, all of this is of the Lord. Because this is the heart of the people, and he's going to go through, is like we read when Rehoboam, Samuel's son, became king. And God worked those events to take the tribes away from him to give to Jeroboam. It was of the Lord, as it tells us there. I mean, this was in God's plans as something that he was doing because of the situation with the hearts of the people, which God responds to. So he's going to end up giving them what they're demanding. But even though it's not going to be for their good, but it's because of what they're like and their lack of faith in him. And we'll get a chance to explore that some more here in a little bit. But for right now, we can see that it says his sons didn't walk in Samuel's ways. They turned aside after lucre, which, what does that mean? As it says there, they took bribes. They were judging for money. So they were selling their judgment. They were corrupt, is what that says. Now, I mean, that sort of thing goes on in our own day and time. And it happens in our own country that we see situations like this where leaders will take money for their judgment and for their decisions. That's a sad thing. It's an evil thing. But they were doing that. And they perverted judgment. That's what happens when you're not judging based on the merits of the case and what's right and wrong, but judging according to who's going to give you the most money. That's not righteous at all. And that's going to displease the people for sure. Now, Samuel's not like that. We're going to see he even gives them an opportunity later to go ahead, step forward, and if I've ever wronged you, here, name what I've taken from anybody here. And that's going to come up a bit later, but nobody says a word. Samuel has judged righteously all of his days, and nobody's accusing him of any evil in his judgment, but his sons aren't like him. So because of that, at this time then, we see a gathering of the elders of Israel, and they come to Ramah in verse 4. And we'll see what they say in verses 4 and 5, and Samuel's reaction in verse 6. So verses 4 through 6, Brother Matthew, would you read that for us?
Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah, and said unto him, Behold, thou art old, and thy sons walk not in thy ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord.
All right. So, of course, Samuel lives in Ramah. They come to his house, and they are making this demand. And their reason that they give is, You are old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us, like all the nations. So that begins to betray what's really going on in their hearts. Now, if this is merely a concern for some wicked judges that are in the land underneath the judge, the righteous judge Samuel, if that's all there is to this, if that's the only problem, is the solution to the problem to reject the entire system and then have a monarchy with a king? If all the problem is you've got some wicked judges in some places, what's the solution to that?
Get rid of the
wicked judges. Yes, that's the solution. And then what about the other thing they bring up? And you're old. Well, yes, he's nearing the end of his days. Although not as soon as they're thinking, because he's going to anoint not only Samuel, Saul, but Samuel's also going to be the one that later anoints David. So he's got some time left in him, and he's still got some good work to do for the Lord. That kind of brings up another issue too, doesn't it? So, I mean, who's to decide when somebody's service to God is done?
God.
That's God's decision. And, I mean, who are we to say, well, you're too old to do that? That's really not good thinking there, but they are recognizing he's getting up there in years, and yes, there is going to come a time now when he's going to pass on. But they're presenting this as if, okay, you're about done here. Your sons are wicked, and so as if they're going to be the one to succeed or take over from him and lead the nation into corruption. But is that what's happened during... How long have they had judges now? 400 plus years. When has that ever happened before? Had there been any wicked judges? Not talking about the top judge, but any of the ones working under them. Had there been any that have been wicked in all these years ever in Israel? I mean, during that 400 plus years, I mean, no doubt there have been some at certain times that weren't doing right. But when did that ever cause the entire system that God was governing the nation through to not work? You replace the ones, if they're wicked, they need to be dealt with. But what would happen when a judge got old and died? Well, what always happened before, going back to the book of Judges, is then the nation would leave the Lord's ways. They would reject him, and then they would be put under an enemy and oppressed until they repented. But then what would happen when they repented? God would raise up another judge and choose a judge for them. And it was always somebody righteous. When do we ever read about when they had a judge, that the judge God chose for them was wicked, and that the nation went astray from the Lord under the judge? Any examples of that? They always went astray after the judge died. Under the judge that God would give for them, they wouldn't go astray. So what is this a legitimate... Is this now they have a legitimate point about the wickedness of Samuel's two sons, and something needed to be done about that. But do they have a legitimate point about Samuel's age and looking at this as if when he goes that it's all going to go corrupt because he's gone now? Is there anything legitimate in that concern? That's never been a problem yet. That's one of the reasons why the system of judges was such a good one. So here's an excuse, is really what we've got, isn't it? This is an excuse for them to demand what they really want and what's really in their hearts at the end of verse 5.
Want to be like the world.
They want to be like the world. They want to be like all the other nations here.
Why was Samuel not judged for his son's behaviors like Eli was? I mean, it would seem the context is that maybe Samuel reprimanded his son, but does it ever say anything about that?
We just don't have any further details. One of the things we do have, though, is there's some distance involved. Now, with Eli, he was at the tabernacle, and Hophni and Phinehas were right there with him. I mean, it was all happening in front of his eyes. Would Samuel, did he know when he's up here in Ramah, does he know really that his sons are doing these wicked things down there in Beersheba? There's certainly the difficulty for him to be able to know in the same way that Eli was going to be able to know what his sons were doing when it was right before his eyes. Because this is, Samuel is separated from them by quite some distance. So as he put them there, and we really don't know the details as to how much he knew about what was really going on there. And this may have been the first time that he's gotten a report about their activities and their corruption. Has he even had a chance to deal with this up until now? We don't have any record that he's had an opportunity with the knowledge of what they're doing to be able to deal with them. And this is the first we read about it. So that could certainly be a big difference there with what happened with Eli that we read about. It's a good question. But more than likely, Samuel has not had the opportunity to deal with this. I mean, there's no evidence that he's displeased God like Eli did. We don't read anything about God being displeased with him, with Samuel, because of what his sons were doing. So that could indicate that he hadn't had really the opportunity to deal with them. Would he have? I mean, based on everything else we know about Samuel and the kind of heart that he had, was he, in fact, thinking about the age situation here, he's a lot older than he is what we're reading about in chapter 8 when we get to chapter 15, when Saul spared Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And then what did Samuel, even being older than this at that time, what did he do about it? When God said, here's the kind of judgment that needed to be passed upon somebody, what did he do? He chopped up Agag himself. I mean, he did that. He didn't try to find somebody younger and stronger to handle the matter. That would have been Saul, who was supposed to do it. But when he didn't do it, Samuel did what had to be done. Now, of course, that's not his son, of course. But we can see the heart that he had and his dedication to obeying the Lord no matter what. And there's no reason to think that he would have not rebuked his sons and removed them and handled this if he'd been given the opportunity. But this is the first we read about it. And this is clearly an excuse that the people have to try to get a king. This is what they really want. They want a king, and they want to be like all the nations. That's the bottom line for them. And so they're making this demand now, and using as an excuse, oh, you're old, your sons are corrupt, So that's why we need it. No, what the real reason is, they want to be like the nations around them. And so they're demanding the king instead of a judge. So was it because they're in essence saying that the system of judges is a failure because Samuel has two sons in a far off location that aren't doing right. Now, how can you condemn that entire system based on the actions of these two guys down in Beersheba? I mean, that is not legitimate at all. It's an excuse. So they make the demand, and it says in verse 6 that the thing displeased Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And then he prayed to the Lord. Well, it displeased him. Think from his perspective as he's initially absorbing this. From his perspective, who is he right now? I mean, he is the judge and has been for many years. And then when the people come up and say, "This system of judges is no good. We need a whole new system. We need to have a king instead of judges." And he's the judge. What is that? How does that come across to him? You're saying I'm no good. And so he's viewing this as a rejection of himself. And in a sense it is, but that's not ultimately who they're actually rejecting, which is what comes out in the next verse. And God is going to speak and answer Samuel and tell them what the real problem is. It's not that they are rejecting Samuel, even though it seems that way to him and he's displeased about it. Who are they really rejecting here? The real judge, exactly. It's God, the judge of judges, the one that's over Samuel. I mean, we see Samuel's sons here, and then Samuel's over them on earth. But God, of course, is the one that's in charge of this whole system. So they are rejecting the judge at the top, the very top, and that's the Lord himself. That's what God tells Samuel in verses 7 and 9. Brother Darrell, would you read that for us?
"Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people, and all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. Now therefore hearken unto their voice, albeit yet protest solemnly. Unto them, show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them."
So God says, "All right, I'm going to give them what they're demanding here, but let them know what they're getting." And he's going to tell them, here's what you're going to get. This is what you're asking for. Here's what you're going to get. Here's what it's going to be like. And when it happens like I'm telling you, don't come crying to me about it, because I'm not going to listen. That's literally what he tells them in the rest of the chapter, which we'll get to in a minute. But he's going to let them know right up front exactly what they're going to get, but they're going to demand it anyway, and he's going to say, "Okay, it's yours." But he identifies in verse 7 when speaking to Samuel, he says, "Listen to their voice and give them the king." But he says, "They have not rejected you, they have rejected me that I should not reign over them." Now, as far as seeing this kind of rebellion against the entire system of the judges, what they're demanding here, has Samuel in his lifetime seen anything like this? Now, he, of course, comes to be a judge at the time when Israel as a nation is at a very low point spiritually. They're not following God, and he's the one that helps to lead them to that repentance that we were reading about in chapter 7, finally. And then they win that battle over the Philistines. And of course, right on the heels of that, at a moment when things are turning around or have turned around and they're so much better than they had been, then this comes about. And the devil doesn't ever leave us alone, does he? And right when they've taken such good steps like they did, well, then here comes something else. And the devil's going to attack from one side and the other. And if we get things shored up on the one side, he's going to try to find an opportunity to come in the back door if he can. Reminds me of a situation in the New Testament. You remember in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 when the church at Corinth had a fornicator in their midst and they weren't doing anything about it. And in 1 Corinthians 5, they were rebuked for that, and they were commanded to deliver that one to Satan, to come together, and they couldn't keep company with him. They were going to not even be able to eat with this one, but they were told to take action against that evil so that that little leaven would not leaven the whole lump. Well, did they obey? When we turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2, we read about their obedience and that they had put this one away. But we also read in 2 Corinthians chapter 2 that the man repented, and now they were having to be commanded to receive him back because now they were refusing to forgive him when he repented. And they were warned in verse 11 that that was a way Satan was getting advantage over them by that device now of not forgiving the one who had done wrong. So look at how that went from one extreme to the other. First, the devil got them not to even stand against evil in the first place. And when they repented of that, then he comes in the other side and gets them to harden their hearts where they're not even willing to forgive a sinner who repents. So they went from one error to the other. And the devil works that way. So if you've got a problem on one side, you recognize that, you work on that. If we're not looking around at every side at all times, I mean, he's going to come. And so they worked on those problems that we saw in chapter 7. They have repented, but now the devil's after them here in another way. Has Samuel seen anything quite like this in his time? No, but he's thinking, well, they're rejecting me. But what does God point out, particularly in verse 8? What is he letting them know? Is this new to God? This is what God's been putting up with them now for 400 plus years. Samuel's just now getting a small taste of what the Lord's been dealing with for centuries on their part. And so he's letting them know this is what they've been doing going back to when they left Egypt. So I've been having to deal with this for a long time, but they're rejecting me, not you. So he's letting Samuel know how far back these problems go with these people. They have been forsaking God and serving other gods and doing these things from the time of Egypt. He says, so do they also unto you. So now they're doing to Samuel what they've been doing to God for all this time. But this is really a rejection of God, as he said in verse 7. They're rejecting God's reign over them. All right, now, when we look at, this will give us an opportunity to consider how they were rejecting God at this time. When we look at the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, this is a physical nation. It's a shadow of the spiritual nation of Israel that we are as God's church. We're a spiritual nation. We're the spiritual kingdom. But this physical nation of Israel is a shadow of that. And all that was set up to foreshadow what would be coming under Christ in the New Testament. But they were a physical nation. And as a physical nation, they had a law, and the law of Moses was given by God for them as a nation. But it served really a dual purpose. Does the law of Moses contain commandments to govern their spiritual life as far as the religion they were to practice under Jehovah? Well, certainly all of that is in there in the law of Moses. But what else does a physical nation require to function? You have to have a civil law. And that's what we see with Israel. I mean, with Israel, you have both the religious aspect and the civil aspect, and that's all covered in the law of Moses. So that's why there are laws to govern everything. That's also another reason why we're not under that system today. Because we're a spiritual nation. We don't need a civil law from under the New Testament. I mean, we're part of all these nations of the world, Christians are. So we're under the civil laws of whatever land we live in. The New Testament is a religious law. But the law of Moses covered both. I mean, it covered everything. So now with the judge... the judges that were over them, their responsibilities pertain to which side? Both. That's exactly right. And see, that's something we have to keep in mind. So in choosing a judge, God would choose someone, a leader, that was going to be able to properly take care of both sides here. Now, what are some of the concerns on the civil side, being a physical nation? What are some of the things that are some of the aspects of that a leader of the nation would have to deal with? And, of course, these are broad. This is kind of some read-my-mind stuff, but what are some of the big categories of things that would fall into this side of things? Well, part of it we just saw in the first three verses of this chapter, which is going to also, it's not like there's a clear division sometimes with these, but what about in judgment? In dealing with cases involved with the citizens of the nation, I mean, there are different disputes and other things that would arise. And of course, they would have to follow the religious teachings, the teachings about what is righteous to guide them in their judgment. But that's a big area of any civil government, is dealing with, well, we have a system of courts and all of that dealing with these things. And that's the case in every nation. But you've got all the things that to deal with the side of judgment. But what's another, when we're talking about any civil government, that's a big area. What's another big area? When we think, especially if we're thinking in terms of the nation, what's one of the biggest issues or biggest responsibilities that a government has for its citizens?
Protected.
There you go. And, there you get into the military aspect and dealing with their political enemies. I mean, the other nations that would be a threat, physical threat to their existence. So you have all of that. You have that side of things too. So you have some big categories over there. The reason we're putting this up there, these issues are going to be dealt with and there are also questions in terms of this system of government that God had for them under the judges. Now, with the religious, you have all the aspects of that. And as Brother Johnson was pointing out, the judge of Israel, whoever he was, or she in the case of Deborah, was responsible for all of this. And we ask a question now, as far as the judges, did the system, or who chose that system? So God says they're rejecting me that I should not reign over them. Who chose the system of judges for Israel? That was the system of government that God ordained for his nation when he made them a nation, when they inherited that land of Canaan. That's what, in fact, from the time they left Egypt, that's the way it was. God is the one that had ordained this system. Now the question, did that system work? Under the judges, did it work for their spiritual well-being? Did it work for them in terms of the civil side and function of the nation, in dealing with areas of judgment, and also in dealing with their enemies? Where did it ever fail in any of these categories? Andy?
It's kind of interesting that even today we have, God has set a system in place for us to follow that works very well, and people will come in and say that it's old and outdated, and we need to do something else, we need to get with the times. You know, same type of stuff that Samuel's faced with here,
yes,
is still prevalent today in our world.
That's why we're taking the time to go through this, and we're not going to finish it all this morning, but that is the very reason for it, because if we look at the root issues here, they're still very much alive and unwell among us today. We're still facing the same types of thinking. The devil is the same devil that was around back then that's here today. And he still gets even children of God to get thinking in some of these wrong ways even now. The specifics may be different, but the overall thinking, erroneous thinking that they had, the problem in the heart that they had, are similar to problems that people still have today, just as Brother Andy was pointing out. And there are lots of people that will just want to throw out the system that God has given us in the New Testament for much the same reasons. And so if we can really get down into this and uncover the problems in their thinking and where the problems were in their hearts, then that can help us as far as a defense goes to make sure that we don't fall into the same the same errors that they were confronted with. But as we're looking at this, though, and they're thinking about the system of judges that God chose for them, it was a very successful system. It worked completely because God was the one that was reigning over them, as he says in verse 7. So when God was reigning over them, how could things go wrong? And when he was guiding, when he was choosing the judges and he was guiding them in their judgment, who was the one fighting their battles against their enemies? Through the judges. Of course, it was God. That being the case, what nation could stand against God? I mean, none of them could. What was the military record of Israel like from Moses all the way up through now to Samuel? How many military defeats did Israel have under the judges? Now, we're not going to count what happened in chapter 4 of this book when Samuel wasn't there, when Hophni and Phinehas, on their own, decided to bring the Ark of the Covenant into the camp, thinking it was going to give them a victory over the Philistines, and they lost two battles in chapter 4. But you don't see Samuel there. You don't see a judge of Israel leading that. That was something they did on their own. We also won't count the time under Moses when chapter 14 when Numbers 14 when God had said, okay, you're not going to enter into the land of Canaan, when the spies returned and they had said they wanted to go back to Egypt, and he said, that's it, you're not going in, none of you, only your children 20 and under are going to enter, and Joshua and Caleb, because they have a different spirit, he said, that's it for you. Well, then they decided on their own they were just going to go fight the Amalekites anyway. And they got defeated when Moses warned them, don't go because God's not with you. So that one doesn't count either because the judge was telling them not to do it. So we can look at those cases. That doesn't go against the judges or that system. The only one that I can really think of was the first battle against Ai when they had the wickedness in the camp with Achan when he buried that stuff in his tent from Jericho. And they didn't go to the Lord beforehand, and they went up and fought against that little town of Ai and lost because of that situation. They fixed it, and then they won the second battle. But other than that, I mean, they had 100% success rate in all these battles because God was the only exceptions were the ones when God wasn't with them. In all the other battles, of course, God was with them, with the judge, and what happened every time. Could they take 300 men and defeat the Midianites and Amalekites together, an innumerable company that was like grasshoppers for number? Could they do that with only 300 when God was fighting with them, for them? That's what happened. There's no failure with that. So when you examine the record of the system that God had chosen for them, there's no failure there at all. God had delivered them from all their enemies. Turning over quickly to chapter 12 here in 1 Samuel. And Samuel brings this up here at the time now when he's anointing Saul as their first king. He is going to remind them of once more right at the as this age of the kings begins. He's going to remind them of the error of their ways in choosing this. 1 Samuel chapter 12, verses 7 to 11, he says, Now therefore, stand still, that I may reason with you before the Lord of all the righteous acts of the Lord, which he did to you and to your fathers. When Jacob was coming to Egypt, and your fathers cried unto the Lord, then the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, which brought forth your fathers out of Egypt, and made them dwell in this place. And when they forgot the Lord their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, captain of the host of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab, and they fought against them. And they cried unto the Lord and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served Balaam and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us out of the hand of our enemies and we will serve thee. And the Lord sent Jerubbaal, which that's Gideon, and Bedan and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side and you dwelled safe. And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the children of Ammon, came against you, you said unto me, nay, but a king shall reign over us when the Lord your God was your king. So he's reminding them of the history and covers, just very briefly there, hit some of the high points, but of all that at time of the judges, what did he say had happened with their enemies? In verse 11. They were delivered every time. So they had a system where they had deliverance from their enemies, they had righteous judgment, And they were led in God's way spiritually so that the Lord was with them and blessed them. That's what happened under the judges the entire time. With the only exceptions being when a judge would die and then they would forsake the Lord and be punished for it until they repented and he would raise up another one. But under the judges, when they had a judge over them, what went wrong? Nothing went wrong. But now they're rejecting God and his leadership over them for another system, and he's going to explain to them. Now here are the problems with the system you want. But we do have a bit more to look at there. Unfortunately, we're out of time here. But if you can just kind of hit the pause button there for a week, Lord willing, we will get back to this next Sunday morning. There's a lot more we want to look at here, a lot of things to consider, some lessons to learn from this mistake they were making. But we learn a lot about how God works. We also learn from this how we need to trust the Lord and not trust in ourselves or in something other than God. And when God has told us, here's the right way to go, we need to trust him and follow his way and not turn to some other way like they were doing and like so many people do even today. But we'll stop there for now and resume, Lord willing, next week.